And welcome to the Industry 4.0 Community Podcast, sponsored by IIoT.University, the Mastermind Accelerator Program, a 16-week program. I am your host with the most, Walker D. Reynolds. This is going to be a quick one, 30 minutes. This is my Hanover Messi initial thoughts summary. Just got back to the States, just got into the studio. On my flight back, I was collating everything. I'm just going to quickly go through the show, some observations that I made, talk about some conversations and some interesting tech that we came across, kind of like what was my initial thoughts. I'm going to start actually with what it's like to go to Hanover Messe. So for those of you who don't, who've never been to Hanover Messe, I have been before, but it's been a few years since I've been, kind of what it's like. So flying from the States, we left on Saturday evening and we had a 10-hour flight into London, 6-hour layover, and then we flew to Hanover, got in the middle of the night, got a cab to our Airbnb, and was in bed by 1 o'clock in the morning, one, maybe two in the morning local time in Hanover, which was 7 PM our time. And we were at the show first thing Monday at like 9:30. Let me start with this. So for those of you who have never, if you're planning on going to Hanover next year, which I'm strongly encouraging you to do that, because I have not an announcement, but more of an idea that will turn into an announcement. You know, if you've never been to Germany before, Germany is a different animal. Actually, the European Union is a different animal, with the exception of the UK. Like, if you're in England and you're from the States, it's going to feel pretty familiar. You know, England is kind of the United States of Europe, although it's not the same as the US. If you're getting an Airbnb, which is what I recommend you do, note that an Airbnb and most of the Airbnbs in Germany and Hanover specifically are not like what you expect in the States. It's really that place that you're staying in, that apartment you're staying in, is only being rented out one time the whole year, and it's for Hanover Messe, and it's like through an agency. So all of the things that you're kind of accustomed to in an Airbnb, it's not likely they'll be there. So we got an apartment about a mile from the show. We were much closer than most of the other people I knew who had Airbnbs. They were like 20 minutes away. That's really a terrible idea. You kind of want to be close. Traffic is really bad. The population in Hanover is about 500,000 people, and it more than doubles for the show. It considerably more than doubles for Hanover Messe. Another thing is the apartments are really, really small in Germany. So if you're kind of what you're used to in the United States, I mean, a lot of times what we were saying was, oh my God, I can't imagine like living here. Like the way, you know, what you're accustomed to in the United States, just it's not what you're used to. Things open late and close early. So you want to make sure you get groceries for your place. Most people go out to dinner in the evening and they do fellowship and strategic partnerships and stuff. So most of the time, if you go to Hanover Messe, you're going to end up going to some type of dinner each night. The show goes Monday to Friday, and the show opens at 9 o'clock and ends at 6 o'clock each day. They have lots of food. It's enormous. I mean, I was there 3 full days in the show, and I only went into 3 buildings. I went into 9, 15, and 16. So 9 is kind of where the legacy manufacturers were. Siemens was the big player there. OPC Foundation, ODVA, all, you know, that kind of stuff were in IFM. Was in building 9. Building 15 was kind of where everything was happening. 15 is kind of where you wanted to be. It was an interesting dichotomy between 9 and 15. I'm going to talk about here in a second. There's plenty of food that you'll be able to eat at the show. A gazillion people. They have a great app, the Hanover app, so to kind of find what you're looking for. It would be very, very difficult to kind of hit the whole show without a plan, like to see. I mean, I think it would be impossible to see every booth. I don't know how you'd even do it. It'd be really, really tough. There's a lot there. There's a gazillion people there. It's everybody, anyone you can think of. So we had a plan. Our team basically coordinated meetings and We knew which booths we were going to and when, for the most part. Most of my days were scheduled. Okay, so I had a team of six with me. We brought our media crew, and then we brought our chief experience officer, our director of engineering, our chief operating officer, and our business development manager, myself, and a media person. And, you know, we had a plan, and it worked out great. All right, so let me kind of go over day one. So day one, our plan, that was Monday. Day one, which I didn't publish any of this stuff on LinkedIn, but I'll talk about it now. I referenced this conversation I had with a Microsoft architect. I can't remember the guy's name, but if I'll put it in the comments down below. The first thing that we did was we met at the bistro in Building 9, which we met there every single morning to have breakfast. And then we went right over to the OPC Foundation booth. We went to OPC Foundation booth. My first takeaway was holy disappointment. Okay, so OPC Foundation, what the fuck are you guys doing? I mean, I have some photos I'll go through, but here, those of you who are listening on the podcast, I'm not going to share my screen, but I am going to share some photos at the end so you can kind of see photos I took and stuff. But I have a photo of the OPC Foundation booth, or a piece of it. The OPC Foundation booth was just like a bunch of walls with lots and lots of words on it, which is not a surprise. I mean, they literally like wrote a book on a bunch of walls. And it wasn't a surprise. There were no significant functional demos. In fact, there were no real functional demos. It was just, you know, they had a couple of partners there. Microsoft was one. I'm trying to think who was right behind Microsoft. I think it was maybe three partners on the very end, and then the rest of the booth was OPC Foundation. They obviously recognized me when I got there, and you know, they didn't want to see me. So nobody told me to leave, but they weren't the least bit interested in engaging. It was a very interesting approach. Let me say this: the OPC Foundation's in a lot of trouble. I mean, leadership wise, there's just a huge groundswell of, hey, the OPC Foundation needs new leadership. There's a huge movement, groundswell saying the leadership's got to get turned over, starting with the president and then moving on to, you know, one of the guys who leads most of the working groups. And, you know, I'm definitely in the camp that those guys they got to go. My first conversation was what happens when I got there, our whole team was there. They recognized me, and the guy at the Microsoft booth, he went to go find a guy, or the Microsoft stand. He went to go find a guy who was the principal architect for AXD Time Series. So I can't remember the guy's name. I will put it down below. He was your typical Microsoft guy, smart, uber arrogant, tons of oozing hubris, knows what's best, typical IT guy, right? But sharp though. Yeah, I mean, he knows his craft. The issue is not at Microsoft, it's not that they don't know software. The issue is that they don't know operations. They don't know manufacturing. That's why Azure is fucking miles behind Google and AWS. When I say miles, I mean miles. If you Microsoft's in trouble when it comes to Industry 4. They are not even remotely close to where Google and Amazon Web Services are. I mean, and that was abundantly clear. If your foundation of your digital infrastructure, so that L4, L5 layer, your cloud layer is Microsoft, I really struggle to see how you're going to be successful. I really struggle to see. I will say this. So the guy and I are going back and forth. We start up. He was a dick to begin with. And we were talking about Tesla. We made a comment about Tesla. And he said Tesla's going to be out of business next year. That's what he said. He goes, they'll be out of business next year. And I said, well, obviously you don't know how Tesla's, you don't know what Tesla's business model is. And I said, and now you expect me to trust the rest of your judgment after you made that claim? Come on. which is preposterous, right? It's preposterous. Tesla will be out of business next year. All auto manufacturers are under a lot of pressure. Some of them are hiding it better. The fundamental issue in auto right now is high interest rates, so people aren't borrowing money to buy cars. That's a fundamental issue. I actually argue that Tesla's in a better position to absorb those stresses because they have other revenue streams, okay? That's not the financial industry. So anyway, he and I go back and forth. I ask him if he wants to. He walks me through a little bit of AXD time series, which is the replacement for the failed TSI, Time Series Insights. And during that conversation, I asked the guys, I said, do you guys know why Azure IoT failed? You know, and I said, can you tell me why they failed? And I said, I know. I just want to know if you guys know. And they said, well, because nobody bought it, which is that's a typical Microsoft answer, right? That the end goal is just getting someone to buy whatever. It doesn't matter. You know, that's why they invest so much in the sales side and the CRM. In the delivery, they don't really give a shit. You know, it's like, hey, we can fool people 2 years at a time and they won't know better for 24 months. They're not going to know for 2 years before that they got sold a bill of goods. So we've got 2 years of revenue. Right. And they do that all through their partners like Accenture and that kind of stuff. So it's a typical Microsoft answer that Azure IoT failed because no one bought it. Well, the truth is a lot of people tried, did a lot of proof of concepts that failed a lot. Right. Time Series Insights failed from a technical perspective. Time Series Insights was an attempt by Microsoft to keep you within the Microsoft Cloud ecosystem once you got your data there. And an example was you were required to put this unique Microsoft header. You'd have to prepend it to any of the data, you know, the data that you were inserting into the TSI backend. We did this with a soft drink, you know, that we discovered it when we did an integration for a large soft drink producer. And they once they realized that that's what Microsoft required, they were out of there. The assumption was that you'd be using, you know, Azure, what is it, IoT Edge or whatever it was, IoT Edge gateways, which would prepend that header for you. That's not, by the way, it's not open. It's not open if what you're doing is you are structuring the protocol and the naming structure, the protocol and the payloads to be consumed specifically by an OEM, right, in your infrastructure. And that OEM in this case was Microsoft. So we had a long conversation about why it failed. We set up I asked him if he'd be interested in doing an interview. He said he'd love to. And then I'm going to tell you that story. He sent an email the next day. This is the very first time this ever happened to me. He sent an email the next day to our CXO saying, here's all the rules for the conversation. We're not going to talk about this, 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 and this. You can't ask this question. You can't ask that question. First time I've interviewed thousands of people. First time anyone's ever put those requirements. So I told my team, I'm not going to do the interview. We got lucky. He later said, oh, I got a scheduling conflict. We'll have to reschedule. And then we just didn't reschedule it. Okay. I will get the answers on AXD for you guys later in a later video. But let me say that I couldn't possibly have been more disappointed in my interaction with Microsoft and the OPC Foundation. It was basically no interaction with the OPC Foundation. I'll tell you an interesting story later. And the Microsoft interaction was nothing but pure hubris. And they do not fucking get it. Let me tell you an interesting an observation I made at Hanover Messe. So this is still on Monday. Something just sort of popped into my head, and it was, you know, I think I know the problem here with these legacy manufacturers or legacy OEMs. So Building 9 was like where all the legacy people were for the most part. They were sprinkled in other places, but really Building 9, you could tell the way that they put Building 9 up, they kind of thought these are the leaders, and it really wasn't. It was the legacy OEMs. And I talked to a bunch of them. There was no company more disappointing than Siemens. I gotta be honest with you. for a bunch of reasons. I think Siemens is doing a lot of good stuff in a lot of areas, but they had a gazillion-dollar booth. They spent a shit ton of – if I was a customer of Siemens, I would have been pissed if I had gone to Hanover Messe and saw that booth, because that's my money you spent on that booth. That's my money as a customer. I mean, and it's like – it's almost as if they don't get it. It's like, you know, when I go to Folsom, California, and I go to the corporate headquarters of Inductive Automation when they built that new headquarters in Folsom – when I first did that tour, I wasn't impressed. I was appalled. I was like, if I'm a customer, I'm pissed at seeing this. That's my money. It's my money you're building this with. Not your money. My money. Because end users and systems integrators and OEMs are the customers. And the big customer is the end user. So I'm not impressed with the big glitz. Contrast that with Google, who had a huge area, but what their area was subdued. It was a typical Google thing, you know, everyone wearing Google t-shirts, and they were hipsters, but everything, you could tell that they didn't spend as lavishly as like Siemens did. It was much more subdued, but still really, really high quality, right? It wasn't wasting the customer's money, right? All right, so after that conversation with the Microsoft guy, we had a meeting with HiByte right away. So we went over to Building 15. HiByte was set up in the AWS section in Building 15. So and Building 15 was kind of where you needed to be. It was kind of where all the bleeding edge tech was, like all the two good Gen AI products that I saw, all the MQTT brokers. Like 15 was where it was at. I mean, so we spent a lot of our time in 15 and 16. 16 is where Litmus was, Google, Microsoft was there, and then the Canada region where we went to go see One Way Automation, Ravil, and One Way Automation was over in that area. 15 was really where it's at. AWS, again, very subdued but very high quality. The Snowflake was in the AWS area. HiByte was there. We had a great conversation with John Harrington, did an interview with John Harrington from HiByte. We saw the Amazon, the AWS SFC, the Shopfloor Control. That's the stuff Blotta was talking about with Kotlin. We got to see the new generative AI, the Copilot from Tulip. Fucking looks sick as fuck. If anybody, you need to see the two demos. So there's two demos in there. Let's talk about Tulip here for a minute. Tulip was doing, you guys remember, I did an interview with Mason Glidden, who was the head of engineering, and now he's the chief product officer at Tulip. I did an interview with him at, I think it was Digital Factory in Boston last year. And that was when the beta of Copilot came out. There's two Copilots now at Tulip. There's the one that they were betaing last year, which is basically how do you put Copilot in an application where like a user can use it. So an operator is interacting with Copilot to ask for information about data, like, hey, what's our top five downtime reasons, that kind of stuff. And then they have a new Copilot, which is on a layer up top, which is in the actual platform. So now, and you should ask for this demo, they have a Copilot where a new developer, so like, let's say I haven't been involved in building the applications for this customer. I can go and click on that Copilot and ask that Copilot to explain to me, what do we have here? What apps have been built? What components have been built? And you can actually tell the Copilot, okay, give me a list of all the components that have been built to interface with work orders. And then it'll give you the list and go, okay, I want you to use that component, add a column to the table. I want you to give me a drop-down list, do this, build this component, click enter, it'll build the component and then you can drag it on the screen. I mean, it's fucking sick. It's a way of like onboarding. The real potential I see is like onboarding new developers, like upskilling the people who are gonna build the applications on the plant floor. Like that new Copilot is gonna do that. So that was really sick. That Tulip was right next to AWS. Tuesday morning, Matthew, I cannot remember Matthew's last name. Sorry, I do apologize. From Gausto and John Harrington from Hibite did a presentation on a UNS case study in the AWS booth. There were like, if there was a big contrast between building 9, which was like the legacy OEMs, and building 15, which was like all the tech we talk about all the time, was use cases. Like Tulip's booth was literally a production line. AWS literally had a bike factory. And none of, and this wasn't demo shit. Like I was going up and I was taking them off script. You know what I mean? Like I when Tulip was doing their demo for the Copilot, I literally said to Eric Marendette, no, let's do this. Ask it this question. It was my question, not his pre-scripted one. And for example, I said, ask the Copilot to give me a report that orders my schedule, gives me the schedule for SKU 001, which was the first SKU that they had in the system, ordered by due date. And it just spit out the fucking, and then you could tell Copilot how to manipulate that table. Okay, drop these two columns, give it to me in a line diagram. I mean, it was really nuts. Tulip has they're way further ahead on Copilot than anybody. I mean, way further ahead for a specific OEM who's embedding Copilot into their product for industry. This is an operations platform. They are by far the furthest ahead. Not even close. The only other company that I was even remotely impressed with on their Gen AI was a company called SoftServe. They're based out of Ukraine. They're kind of like the Capgemini of the Ukraine. But they have a new agnostic Gen AI platform, brand new. I don't think they only have a couple of example use cases. I mean, literally, they just launched it. It's through a partnership with NVIDIA. So it's different than Tulips. Tulips is in their platform. And their platform is an operations platform. The Tulip interface is operations platform that is implemented out on the machinery. SoftServes is, I can't remember the name. It was a really weird name. I kept forgetting it. Their marketing team's got to do a better job with the name because it's like four words. I just can't remember it. I just keep thinking of it as SoftServe. So that's a marketing failure on their part. But the technology was really incredible. Like, so think of agnostic Gen AI integrated with PLM, so or like your building management system. So now, like the big thing is like using it for digital work instructions. So like the big use case that I saw for the software, and I only got a chance to see it for 10 minutes, but I was definitely impressed, was like contract manufacturing, where I run a facility where organizations contract us to manufacture their products, where I have to upskill and train my employees over and over and over again. Their platform is the type of platform that you're going to drop in and quickly train operators on how to do their job for a new product. It was really sick. Very, very impressive. I want to do a much deeper dive on it, but that was a big SoftServe and Tulip AI and the Gen AI Tulip were the two best on Gen AI. Let's talk about Litmus. So on Tuesday, I spoke in a fireside chat, which we are going to publish. So that'll be available on the YouTube channel at Litmus's booth. The turnout from the community was phenomenal. I'm going to talk about the community in a minute. I can't believe the number of people who went to Hanover Messe just to meet us. Like, that blew my mind. I mean, we had somebody who traveled from Dubai, and their only reason for going to Hanover Messe was to meet with us for 10 minutes. Like, their boss sent them, you go to Hanover Messe and you meet with these guys. You find them and you meet with them and ask these questions, get connected to them, and bring them back to the UAE to help educate over here. Like, that just blew my mind. I'll talk about that in a second. The fireside chat that I did Tuesday night with myself and Litmus, Vatsal Shah from Litmus, that'll be available on our YouTube channel. A couple things I just want to talk about was I was thinking about this thing I learned on Monday. Like, where do I think the problem actually lies? And here, that is, why is it that it seems like the OEMs and the vendors don't get what the actual problem is? Well, and so why is it they're making products that don't bridge the gap, that, that don't solve the actual problem manufacturers facing? You know what the problem that manufacturers are facing? And I talked about this before. The manufacturers care about three things. Whenever they build a solution, whenever they buy software, buy a machine, or they invest in their business, the commercial elements that they care about, there are only three things. Number one, they care about what is the initial capital expenditure. Number two, they care about the high availability, like how available is it going to be for us, how valuable it will be for us. And number three, they care about performance, right? And the last one is total cost ownership. But that I grouped that into the first one. So CapEx, availability, performance, TCO. That's what they care about. If you can't answer those four questions, this is why I say how long does it take and how much, and you will not believe the number of vendors that are just like, well, that depends. I can't really. Well, if a vendor can't ever tell you how much it costs, fucking run. It means they're going to rip you off. It means that it's going to cost as much as they can convince you to pay. Okay, that's what it means. When they can't tell you how much it's going to cost, they're telling you that means it costs as much as they can convince you or trick you into paying. Okay, so let me message to vendors, all these people who requested I come do meetings with you. Okay, if you can't answer that question, don't waste my time, please. Okay, because I'm gonna call you out on it. Right, that's number one. Vendors don't talk in that language. And they don't care. They're just trying to, you could tell these shows are built to fool executives. Like, it's the people who go to Hanover Messe specifically are not, it's the bulk is like executives, IT professionals. It's not the end user. The operators would be very dissatisfied if they were to go to Hanover Messe, because they'd want to see meat and potatoes application. What does it mean for me? And they wouldn't get it. Okay. Here's the second issue that vendors have that I took away from Hanover Messe. It is IT people developing tech and then trying to find a market for it instead of starting with the problem the customer has and working their way back to the solution as part of a much larger initiative. Okay, digital transformation works when we start with problems and work our way back to solutions. It and solve them within an infrastructure. Excuse me. And it just kind of blew me away. And when I was doing the fireside chat at Litmus, I talked about that. One of the big, you know, and then after the fireside chat, I literally stood around. I literally was there for another 90 minutes. There was a big long line of people who wanted to talk. And I tried to talk to every single person who came there to meet me. Yeah, and I'll get to that here in a second. It was, you know, UMH. Let me talk about this. So I went and talked to, the United Manufacturing Hub and HiveMQ initially. I got a great demo from HiveMQ. HiveMQ has added in a new module feature. And one of the tests that they showed was how you can write a module that will, at the broker level, convert SparkPlug B payloads, so decode them from Google Protobuf, and then convert them to JSON so that all the consumers are consuming the message as a JSON. The clients don't have to be able to decode Protobuf, okay? I had a bunch of conversations. Dominic who is the CTO at HiveMQ. Everybody I talked to, I proposed a couple of ideas. And one of the ideas was, hey, MQTT is really missing something in the standard that tells us how we should write methods on top of topics. So if I wanted to go topic.aggregate, or, you know, so when I'm connected to the broker, I want to be able to call on a method, topic.aggregate or topic.convert, like from, say, Celsius to Fahrenheit. There's nothing in the standard right now that tells you how to do that. So we're really leaving it to the OEMs to write whatever they want, and then you've got to learn, depending upon which broker you're using, you got to learn how to use their mechanism from the OEM. All the vendors agreed, from Sodalo's Mosquito Pro. Philip from that organization, from EMQX, HiveMQ, everybody agreed that we need that topic support and it needs to be in the standard. And everyone also agreed when it came to SparkPlug that we need to be able to put the SPB v1.0 root topic anywhere in a namespace. So right now, the way SparkPlug works is you have to publish your edge of network nodes into one root node, and it's SPB v1.0. And then the specification tells the clients to look for that root node. What we want to do, the spec needs to do, is allow me to put SPB v1.0 wherever I want. So I have many of them in my UNS, okay? So for example, I should be able to go enterprise site area line one, edge namespace, and inside of edge have SPB v1.0. And then if I go to another line, see the same thing. And what SPB v1.0, I could have one device in there. I could have many devices, okay, in each of those namespaces. And everyone agrees that's something we need to have. There was nobody who said, no, I don't think that's a good idea. Everybody said. So I think those couple of things are definitely going to happen within the MQTT specification, whether it's a new industrial spec or whether it's in SparkPlug. Okay. HiveMQ was way impressive. Portainer was way impressive. Sodalo, which has MQTT Pro, most people don't even know that, was incredibly impressive. I'm going to talk about some of this stuff in a follow-up video. A couple of other things. Let me make sure I get to... All right. I want to talk about what I was most impressed with, and then I want to talk about the community. So there's a technology that we discovered while we're there. I'm not going to mention the company's name because we're going to do a deep dive on it before I do that. But it's essentially an AI analytics platform that looks pretty impressive. Our director of engineering is doing a deep dive on it. And then the rest of the team will take a look at it. It looks like a game changer. Google Cloud Cortex Framework, which we worked with Google on. I did the initial reviews, and then our director of engineering worked with Google on the demo that they built for manufacturing operations, which was just fucking... I mean, Google is the only cloud provider who has resources on staff who actually understands what additive context for industrial data is. Like, their demo gave us the ability to add metadata from ERP, CMMS, warehouse management, right onto the topics, and then allow us to cross-reference that metadata so that I could go and retrieve from using Google Lookup. I could go retrieve directly from the ERP the bill of materials on a return. Or I was able to look at the actual sample collections for the quality metric that I was, it all from one dashboard. And it had to do with the way that Google Cortex Framework is structured and the way that they apply additive context from UNS. Really fucking impressive. I mean, I was blown away. And I knew that was the direction they were going, because I can talk about it now because we have a press release coming out. I knew that that was the direction they were going. I just didn't know they were as far as they were because I hadn't looked at it. I saw it at Hanover Messe. So Google Cloud, the Cortex Framework, big deal. IFM, their Moneo platform looked really impressive. Marco Donovan took a look at it too. Their Bluetooth mesh technology looks really impressive to turn dumb sensors into smart sensors. So you guys have seen the Shark device, which is from Mr. IoT in Chicago, which turns a dumb sensor into a smart sensor for $200-$300. So basically it takes that 4 to 20 or 0 to 10 signal, allows you to model that signal as an instrument, and then publish it into infrastructure over MQTT with a data and information model. And now it's smart. So you take a dumb sensor and make it a smart sensor. And you save, several hundred dollars per sensor doing it. they have, IFM now has Bluetooth technology, Bluetooth mesh, where they have these little tiny sensors with a pass-through, an M2 pass-through. So it goes M2 in, and then it turns it into a smart sensor, M2 out. So it's a pass-through through the to the PLC. Then there's a gateway where all of the Bluetooth mesh devices are collected and where you do all your modeling and stream it either into an open ecosystem using MQTT or to their Moneo IoT platform. That was really impressive. One other thing that I kind of really stood out to me, and I'm going to go into a bunch more here, was Dell invited us to a meeting. We got a chance to meet with Todd Edmonds, who's a CTO of smart manufacturing at Dell. You guys will remember I did a prediction that Dell is going to make a major play in industry. I got to see what that major play was. I didn't know it. I actually thought it was going to be an acquisition, but actually what they did was they developed what's known as Dell Native Edge, okay? Came out last year. The best way to describe it is, the way that they describe it is a platform for infrastructure. So deploying infrastructure, so the physical infrastructure, the servers and everything, Native Edge runs on those servers and runs on those devices, edge devices. But also it's the platform for doing the deployment. It's a really incredible demo that we got a chance to see. Basically plug the server in and then provision the server, then provision the software, then provision the applications, all with the click of a button. And we're talking, instead of days, we're talking minutes for literally getting your implementations stood up. Think of it as, we use Portainer to manage to deploy stacks to edge devices. There's an overlap in that functionality, except this also is on the software. The edge agent is running on the physical device that you ordered. And so your infrastructure, I mean, it's a way of IT managing physical infrastructure for industry in a really seamless way, right? Now there's some downsides to it. It's native to Dell. It's only going to run on Dell hardware for now. I don't know if they're going to apply it to third party hardware. So it's only going to run on Dell servers and stuff, but it was definitely like a wow moment. So that was impressive too. I also saw some impressive stuff with 5G. I'm going to talk about that later. I want to make sure I cover Sandbox. Had a conversation with the guys from Sandbox in Slovenia. They have a new version of Sandbox. You guys have probably never heard of it. It's still in beta, up and coming. We're going to be doing a bunch of work with it. Crosser's doing some cool stuff. Databricks. We talked to Snowflake. They're going to be coming on the podcast that we're going to do with Arlen Nipper. So Arlen Nipper and I are going to do a podcast specifically on using Snowflake to historize UNS. Let's talk about it that way. But we're inviting Pugal from from Snowflake on that podcast. Dell Native Edge. Sodalo. All right. So let's talk about the community, and then I'm going to throw an idea out to you and then get out of here. The community is enormous. Like it absolutely blew my mind, like how huge the community has grown. Normally when I go to a conference, I'll probably have to take 20 pictures in the whole conference. That is, people will come up, oh, you're the YouTube guy, and ask me to take a photo. If I do a speech, I go somewhere and take a speech, give a keynote, I might get maybe 5 to 10 people asking to take a photo. It was no joke. Literally, I'd be talking in a booth and there would be people coming up and just taking photos, you know, and people from all over the world. I mean, I took photos with hundreds of people. I lost count at like 400 photos. We couldn't walk, you know, I mean, there were thousands of people we talked to who all were part of this community. Unified Namespace was everywhere, especially in building 15 and 16. It was everywhere. Like companies I'd never even heard of had UNS. And a lot of yes, was there some misappropriation of the term UNS, and we're going to address that with documentation and the book coming out. But most people got it right. Most of the vendors who are saying UNS got it right. And this, and my point is, this movement has grown much bigger than I ever thought it would. I mean, it is much bigger than I thought it was. And I didn't realize it until I went to Hanover Messe. It was simply overwhelming. It was overwhelming. You know, and on the last day, the very last thing I did was I did a like a community meetup with Portainer and Sodalo. Sodalo is the company that sells Mosquito Pro. Mosquito Pro is the pro version. So it's, think of Mosquito as the OSS Mosquito is in the center, and then Mosquito Pro is the platform that goes around it. It's the data, you know, doing modeling and services and high availability and all that kind of stuff. It's the industrial product. Sodalo is the parent company of Mosquito Pro. So we did a community meetup with Sodalo and Portainer. Portainer is the Docker platform that we use, and management platform. And Neil Cresswell and Philip Strauss, who are the CEOs of both of those companies, we did this meetup there, and I did an interview with them. We talked about OSS software and the challenges. Why is it you should go from, you know, do your proof of concept with open source, but then shift over to the commercial offering with the support and managed services and high availability and SLAs and all that stuff. And Neil Cresswell said to me, you know, a bunch of people came up. I had a chance to talk to the Kepware folks. And one, if you guys want to know what I said to Kepware, hey, you got to do two things. Number one, you need to push the Linux development, and you need containerization. We got to be able to containerize. I got the same answer from Tom Godot I always get, which he always gives me, which is our customers aren't directly asking for that. And my response to Tom should be something like this. And Adam Kennedy, please don't get frustrated with me here when I say this. Stop doing what your current customers are asking, because your current customers aren't the people, aren't your future. Okay? Kepware, your current customers are not your future. Okay? Your future are the people who are in building 15 and 16 at Hanover Messe. They aren't the people who are in building 9. Okay? Linux drivers, containerization. I have engineers here at my company who say, if you don't have a Docker image, I'm not using your software. Like, that's their position. Now, we have to compel them to use software that doesn't have a Docker image. But, and I'm not picking on Kepware here. I love Kepware. I'm high on Kepware. Okay? Still my go-to connectivity platform. They make the best drivers in the world, bar none. Okay? But it was interesting when I said to Kepware, which is really, they're a legacy, they're right on the crux of being a legacy company, because they were, you know, they're really an early 2000s company. When I said containerization, their response was, well, our current customers aren't asking for it. Well, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if they're asking for it. What matters is who the what the future customer wants, what the future install, but where your additional revenue streams are, what they want. And what they want to be able to do is deploy centrally into containers as stacks. Now, Kepware Plus, the cloud-based, which does that centralized administration, will deploy your Kep server instances. But you need to be able to deploy them in an agnostic stack, similar to like writing a Docker Compose file in Portainer and deploying a stack of solutions together out to an edge device. And you shouldn't have to use multiple platforms to do that. All right, but with that, you know, that's my basic overview of Hanover Messe. The idea that I have here, and I want to run this idea by you. There are some people at conferences who are proving it. They're proving value, they're showing value. But the vast majority don't. And I proposed to one of the OEMs, and I got a we didn't get a commitment. We're in agreement in principle on one of the very large OEMs to sponsor a conference that we would put on in Dallas. That's one of the requirements, called Prove It or something to that effect, where we would administer the conference. And the whole concept would be for OEMs to prove their value to manufacturers. And we would write the functional specifications for all the vendors in order to meet those requirements. And then we would give each of them the opportunity to present on their solutions. We would limit it to, you know, I don't know how many vendors, maybe 20 to 50 vendors total, plus we probably limit it to 50 to 1,000 attendees. Let me know if you like that idea, okay? Because it's something we're talking about. It's something we would have to start putting together now. I think we're going to do it no matter what, but I'd love to get some feedback on that. All right, that's just the introduction to what I experienced at Hannover Messe. I would recommend people go. It's an exhausting experience, especially in the United States. I left a day early. I actually changed my flight from Friday to Thursday and left on Thursday, and got some rest so I could get here and shoot all this stuff today. It was an incredible show. You're an incredible community. I was absolutely 100% overwhelmed. We're going to do individual videos on this long list of software and products that I saw coming up in the future. But that's the update for now. All right. Like, subscribe, comment down below what else you'd like to know, and specifically, what do you think about that conference idea? And I will see you in the next one.